This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, March 21st of 2023. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, protesters at more than 100 locations nationwide will rally against big bank investments in the fossil fuel industry today. We'll hear about what's planned for Denver. And the failure of Silicon Valley Bank could affect the fight against climate change. That story and more on This Week in Water. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines. Then it's How on Earth? At 9 a.m., tune in for another archival recording of British philosopher Alan Watts. Then at 9:30, Terry Reardon will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first, it's time for the headlines with KGNU's John Kellen.
Gun safety activists say they've done their part to strengthen laws in Colorado and that now it's time for lawmakers to get a series of measures across the finish line. On Monday, members of Students Demand Action and Moms Demand Action came before the Colorado House State, Civic, Military, and Veterans Affairs Committee in support of legislation to raise the minimum age to buy a firearm in the state to 21. Their testimony yesterday came ahead of additional hearings set for tomorrow in the Colorado House Judiciary Committee on two Senate bills. Senate Bill 23-170 is meant to strengthen Colorado's extreme risk law by restricting access to guns from people who are in crisis. Senate Bill 23-168 would reform firearms industry immunity laws. Advocates of these measures have attended and testified at a series of hearings on gun violence prevention bills in recent weeks. A new near-total abortion ban in Wyoming is already seeing legal challenges. A group of abortion access advocates in Teton County is hoping to block the ban this week. Hannah Merzbach reports for Rocky Mountain Community Radio.
As of Sunday, it's a felony to give an abortion in Wyoming. A bill the GOP-led state legislature passed this year went into effect without Republican Governor Mark Gordon's signature. Teton County provider Joe Venina Anthony says she's already had to cancel three appointments.
What these laws do, they force physicians like myself to choose between providing good evidence-based care and my own welfare, and that's an impossible choice to make.
Anthony is one of several plaintiffs who have filed a legal challenge to halt the abortion ban. A judge will hold a hearing Wednesday. Wyoming is also now the first state to specifically ban abortion pills. Governor Gordon signed that legislation, which will go into effect in July. Anthony says the group will also challenge that law.
That was Rocky Mountain Community Radio's Hannah Merzbach. Denver City Council has approved a more than $5.5 million agreement to help support the acquisition of land for new affordable housing. The agreement with Shanahan Development LLC will finance the purchase of the lot for a six-story building with nearly 200 low-income units in the La Alma Lincoln Park neighborhood. About a quarter of those units will be three- or four-bedroom apartments for families, according to a city press release. Development financing will be provided by Denver's Department of Housing Stability. Shanahan Development will apply for low-income housing tax credit financing, and construction of the building should be finished by 2026. A bill that would require nonprofit hospitals in Colorado to spend more money on so-called community benefit is now before state lawmakers. House Bill 1243 calls for each nonprofit hospital to spend at least 3% of its revenue from treating patients on community benefit. The Denver Post says the measure would also expand the definition of community benefit spending, which currently includes free or discounted health care to those who need it. Meanwhile, the Colorado House of Representatives has advanced three bills to save Coloradans money on health care and improved access to prescription drugs. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
The three bills are meant to reduce health insurance premiums and have easier availability and affordability. House Bill 23-1225 will increase the impact of the Prescription Drug Affordability Board to save people money on out-of-pocket prescription drugs. HB 2324 is aimed to lower health insurance by limiting things like administrative expenses and excessive profit. It would also make it easier for customers to find and compare plans that would lower their out-of-pocket costs. HB 23-1183 would exempt patients with serious or complex medical conditions from being required to use an alternative drug. House Communications Advisor Caitlin Began told KGNU that 23-1183 has passed its third reading and is headed to the Senate, while 1225 and 1224 remain in the House, pending a third reading for each. For KGNU, I'm Steve Miller.
The U.S. Supreme Court is weighing a case that could determine to what extent Native American tribes have rights to divert water from the drought-stricken Colorado River and other major tributaries. KGNU's Benita Lee explains.
The Navajo Nation argues a third of its 175,000 residents don't have running water in their homes. Tribal citizens rely mostly on groundwater, but have fought for access to surface water for decades. States such as Arizona, California, and Nevada want the Supreme Court to block the Navajo Nation's lawsuit, arguing that their own water supplies are running low for cities and agriculture. The Navajo Reservation is the largest in the U.S. at about 25,000 square miles, about the size of West Virginia. The tribe previously reached settlements for water from the San Juan River in the Four Corners region of New Mexico and Utah. The Navajo Nation's lawsuit claims treaties signed with the federal government in the mid-1800s relocating the tribe to their current reservation promised a, quote, permanent home, unquote. Navajo representatives say this promise implies not only land, but also a sufficient supply of water. For KGNU, I'm Benita Lee.
Four people died in three separate winter recreation incidents in the high country this past weekend. The Denver Post says two teenagers died Sunday night while sledding at the Copper Mountain Ski Resort. A statement from the Summit County Sheriff's Department said the two teenagers, both in Colorado from Illinois on spring break, were sledding down a half pipe together when they crashed onto hard ice. Emergency medical attention failed to revive either one. In an unrelated incident earlier Sunday, a skier died in an avalanche near the Aspen Highlands Ski Resort, according to the Pitkin County Sheriff's Office. And on Friday in Gunnison County, a 36-year-old man died after an avalanche buried him in 4 feet of snow. All told, nine people have died in avalanches in Colorado this winter season, according to the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. In today's weather, mostly sunny along the Front Range, with a high of 54 degrees in Boulder, 59 in Denver, 56 in Fort Collins, and up in Nederland a high of 35 degrees. Light snow could move into the metro Denver area tomorrow, with more possible in the high country. A series of winter storms could bring up to a foot of snow in the western mountains, posing a possible travel hazard. For KGNU, I'm John Kellen.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Protesters at more than 100 locations across the country will rally against big bank investments into fossil fuels today. That includes a rally outside of a Chase Bank in Denver. The UN climate report released Monday says at the rate we're going now, the planet will likely push past a dangerous climate threshold within the next 10 years. At this point, the global warming will be irrevocably altered and beyond people's capacity to adapt. The top four financiers of fossil fuel projects in recent years are JP Morgan, Chase, Citi, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America, all American banks. They account for a quarter of all fossil fuel financing in the world. Joining me to talk about the protest in Denver is Giselle Hertzfeld with 350 Colorado and Shauna Foster of Rainforest Action Network, who compiled the yearly Banking on Climate report. Giselle, Shauna, good morning.
Morning.
Hi, good morning.
Giselle, start us off by telling us about today's rallies, specifically the one in Denver and how it relates to those nationwide.
Absolutely. Thank you. So we're part of a multi-generational coalition of environmental and labor groups and retired union activists that are going to be holding a rally today at Chase Bank on 16th Street in Denver as part of a national day of action that's being coordinated by a group called Third Act, which is a group for climate activists over 60 years old that have more than 50 national and local partners. This rally is one of more than 100 events happening in half of the U.S. states taking place across the country, with thousands of people taking action nationally And the goal is to pressure the major banks to stop financing the financing the expansion of the fossil fuel industry. We're hoping to have at least 100 people at the event today. We have 100 people registered so far, and we're going to be at Chase Bank in Denver from noon to 1:30 p.m. And we're going to be joined by a brass band, local musicians. We'll have lots of art and banners, and we're expecting it to be a really fun, really lively event.
And this isn't the first time that climate activists have targeted banks to call on them to stop investing in and financing fossil fuel infrastructure projects. What have been the results of past protests against these infrastructure projects, Shauna?
So with public pressure, we've been able to win policies that are better on climate records. Banks have a huge public relations marketing machine, and they want to look like they are friendly on the climate. They want consumers to feel good about their investments, that when their money is not in the checking account, that it's out there doing good in the world. And what we find is that in order to be aligned with the Paris Agreement, in order to keep global heating under 1.5 degrees centigrade, we really need bank plans to be more focused on absolute emissions and a lot less focused on carbon intensity or carbon markets. And so when consumers show that they are wise to the greenwashing tactics of banks, banks change policies based on consumer demand.
And have either one of you, have you seen the same type of level of investments in clean energy projects from banks? Or is it mostly coming from governments, the bankrolling the green infrastructure?
I can't really say what is going on with the government investments, although the IRA is very good for a lot of renewable energies, not so much on the human rights aspect of an energy transition. Like, we really can't replicate the current fossil fuel exploitative infrastructure when it comes to renewable energy unless we are centering human rights. But what I can say, according to Bloomberg, is that banks as on a whole invest about 80 cents for every dollar that they put into fossil fuels. So that's 80 cents into renewable energies for every dollar they put into fossil fuels. However, if we were in a full just transition mode, banks should be investing $4 into renewable, human rights-centered resources for every dollar they invest in fossil fuel companies. That's what a transition looks like. And banks are doing nowhere near that, especially JP Morgan Chase, who has invested $382 billion in fossil fuel industries since the Paris Agreement was signed in 2016.
And Giselle, the idea of environmental, social, and governance, or ESGs, is that companies should invest in environmentally and socially progressive companies because, or banks should invest in environmentally and socially progressive companies because it mitigates risks. And it seems like a few years ago, big banks were planning to jump onto the ESG bandwagon, but what happened? Why has this not happened?
I mean, I think we're seeing a gradual progression. We're seeing the public momentum being built, the public pressure being built to pressure these institutions, these large financial institutions, to start investing more responsibly. I feel like we need that public pressure and that public mobilization to really push these institutions, but it is not happening anywhere near fast enough. There's also a lot of greenwashing that can happen in ESG. So we need to be careful when we talk about ESG that we're talking about real climate solutions with real targets and real regulations that will actually create real change. There's also a large divestment movement that has just dramatically increased in the past years. We're seeing over 1,500 institutions worldwide divesting from fossil fuels, making the decision to mobilize their capital in a way that leads to a sustainable future instead of global destruction. These 1,500 institutions are worth collectively over $40.51 trillion, and they represent everything from educational institutions, faith-based organizations, governments, pension funds. So we are seeing a shift, but we really need to see it happen a lot faster, especially in light of the new IPCC report.
And on your point of risk, look, people should have the freedom to invest in what they want to invest in. And if people who are near retirement age want to invest in a client, you know, in a bank that is climate responsible, they're helping the bank manage its long-term risks. Recent banks have failed because they have not been able to manage market volatility and long-term risk. And climate risk is definitely one of those things that banks need to manage better. And so we're calling on Chase, who has 7% of their portfolio invested in fossil fuels, to do a much better job of managing its long-term risk, especially when it comes to climate. People want to keep their retirement safe by managing this risk much better than banks have. We don't want a bunch of banks failing because they're not seeing what the climate crisis is doing to us.
And something I wanted to go back to that Giselle, you mentioned that older people, retirees, are participating in today's event. And Shauna, you're talking about pension funds, divestment of pension funds. I think we've heard a lot more about the push to divest on college campuses, but maybe not so much about pension funds. Can you tell me about what's going on there? Or is it as prevalent as on college campuses, or are we just not hearing about it?
I can speak to that. So 350 Colorado has been part of a multi-year effort to get our Colorado State Pension Fund PARA to divest from fossil fuels. And a recent report that was just released this year that was commissioned by the County of Boulder, and it was conducted by Corporate Knights. It shows that PARA has lost $2.7 billion by not divesting from fossil fuels in the last 10 years. There was a previous study that was released also by Corporate Knights in 2019 that showed that PARA had lost $1.7 billion by not divesting from fossil fuels. And just in 3 years, we've seen those losses increase by a whole $1 billion. So not only are fossil fuels a bad investment for our future, but we're also seeing now that they're just a bad investment in general. They're some of the lowest performing parts of PARA's portfolio. And I'm sure PARA is not alone in that. So we're seeing not only the moral rationale, but also a very strong financial rationale for divesting from fossil fuels.
Right. And just to mention, PARA is the retirement, the pension portfolio of public employees. Giselle Hertzfeld is the coordinator for 350 Colorado and the Defunding Climate Disaster Campaign coordinator. Shauna Foster is a communications officer with Rainforest Action Network, who compiled the yearly Banking on Climate report. For more information about today's protest, visit news.kgnu.org. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Two U.S. banks have collapsed this month. As with other events that create uncertainty in the financial market, some consumers are considering the alternative structure of credit unions. Eric Tegedoff has more.
The collapse of two banks has put the U.S. financial sector into focus this week. Some are considering the alternative structures of institutions like credit unions. Troy Stang is head of the Go West Credit Union Association, which represents more than 300 credit unions in Colorado and five other states. He says tumult in the financial market historically generates interest in the local structure of credit unions.
Whether it was with the dot-com bust, whether it was with the activities that led up to the Great Recession, consumers at their kitchen tables started having these conversations more intentionally about who is it that we do our financial services with.
Silicon Valley Bank's collapse is the second largest bank collapse in U.S. history. To get depositors their money, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has stepped in. Stang notes that National Share Insurance Fund, administered by the National Credit Union Administration, is the equivalent regulator for his institutions and is paid for by the credit union system. Stang says credit unions are not-for-profit and member-owned.
We're not accountable to Wall Street investors. We're not accountable to other forces outside of our membership. And so it's a much different model.
Stang says many of the credit unions in his association have spent the last week reassuring customers and noting differences in their institution structure from others. He adds a strong financial system is important for consumers, regardless of which institution they bank with. For Colorado News Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Time now for This Week in Water with Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
The looming threat of phosphageddon. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Silicon Valley Bank in California was the go-to lender for renewable and clean technology firms because SVB, as it's called, understood the industry.
After regulators closed the 40-year-old institution earlier this month, many firms in the environmental sector worried they might go under too until the federal government announced that it would backstop depositors in what was the nation's 16th largest bank.
Still, what happens next is unclear, and companies are concerned investors in climate change-related businesses might lose confidence in the industry.
SVB had made loans to community solar projects that were avoided by larger institutions as too cumbersome. These programs allowed those who can't install their own panels to buy power from local solar farms.
And according to SVB's website, the bank financed over 60% of community solar projects in the U.S. and had committed more than $3 billion to sustainability endeavors.
About 50% of clean tech startups used SVB, and some had just finished new financing when they were locked out of their accounts in which millions of dollars had been deposited.
Now there are hopes among investors that the billions of dollars from the Federal Inflation Reduction Act will ease the pain of the bank failure and restore confidence in the clean technology sector.
A first-of-its-kind report on the world's water resources contains a dire warning. Within about 7 years, the demand for global fresh water will exceed supply by 40%.
The authors of the study by the Global Commission on the Economics of Water say that we are changing the global water cycle, and the resource must be managed as a worldwide common good. They emphasize that we won't fix the climate crisis if we don't fix the water crisis.
According to the study, many governments don't recognize how interdependent they are in the water cycle. No country is on its own. A flood or a drought in one place reflects something going on globally.
Those who make policy have neither ensured equal access to water nor protected it. We are now at the point, according to the report, where 2 billion people lack a safe supply.
The report criticizes governments that subsidize water, usually in ways that favor well-off corporations, including hundreds of billions of dollars that go to agriculture, which can lead to excessive consumption.
Released just before the beginning this week of a critical UN water conference, the report makes 7 recommendations to policymakers, and among them, water must be managed as a common good that is crucial to food security, and it should not be underpriced but affordable for the poor. Also, governments should end agricultural subsidies, and there must be more recycling and reuse of wastewater.
Too little, too much, and perhaps too late. In a crisis scientists are calling phosphageddon, we face both a shortage of phosphorus and its overuse.
Phosphorus is a vital nutrient for living organisms. It is a key element of bones, teeth, and cell membranes, and used to fertilize crops we depend on.
But much of the phosphorus and fertilizer runs off into waterways, creating toxic algal blooms and dead zones in the ocean, like the one in the Gulf of Mexico. Those algal blooms flourish in warmer conditions and then release methane, furthering the climate crisis.
Meanwhile, the sources of phosphorus are shrinking. The U.S. holds only about 1% of global phosphate from which the element is mined and will potentially run out within decades.
The world's biggest supplies are in Morocco, which has been called the gatekeeper of global food supply chains. As reported in The Guardian, many analysts worry a few cartels could soon control most of the world's supplies and threaten food production everywhere.
In his new book, The Devil's Element, Dan Egan says there are solutions such as water quality regulations and recycling phosphorus from human and animal waste.
And finally, chances are you've never heard of mycoforestry, the practice of growing edible mushrooms alongside trees, but new research says it could feed the world and fight climate change.
The amount of forested land being cleared for agriculture is happening at a staggering pace. But Paul Thomas at the University of Stirling wondered, what if instead of having farming and forestry compete, They shared the same land in a mutually beneficial way.
In a recent study, he and colleagues inoculated the roots of tree saplings with a fungus. After the trees were planted and grew, not only did they start to produce mushrooms packed with protein, but also sequestered significant amounts of carbon.
How much? His analysis found the practice of cultivating edible mushrooms in forests could sequester nearly 13 tons of carbon per hectare annually and produce a nutritious food source for nearly 19 million people per year. That's a stark difference when compared to all other major food crops that produce greenhouse gases.
Thomas hopes the concept will mushroom because mycoforestry can not only produce a food source that combats climate change, but will also help conserve biodiversity and protect watersheds.
That's it for this week in Water. Support comes from GC Green, a veteran, woman, and Native American-owned clean energy and resilience solutions company. Learn more at gcgreen.com.
That's it for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Thanks to John Kellen, Steve Miller, Benita Lee, Hannah Mersbach, Alexis Kenyon, Eric Tegedoff, Jamie Sudler, and Franny Halperin for their contributions to today's program. Stay tuned for How on Earth. That's all still ahead after the headlines from the BBC.